from stpetecatalyst.com.
Hey, it's Bill DeYoung here with the Arts Alive podcast from the St. Pete Catalyst. Today, I'm honored to have two of St. Petersburg's most creative creatives in the studio with me from Freefall Theater, Mr. Eric Davis.
Hi there.
There he is. He's the producing artistic director. And Mr. Michael Raby, who is the musical director.
Hello.
And we're here to talk about Oz, a new musical. That's the official title. I'll probably just call it Oz from now on. And this is playing right now, completely original stuff over at Freefall. It's absolutely brilliant. It's there through July 9th. Michael, I wanted to start with you. I think you put on Facebook recently, I wish the 10-year-old me could see what I've done here with this musical. And that makes me think that maybe as a kid you were a Wizard of Oz fan.
I was. I was first captured my heart in the yearly television showings, you know, on TV.
Yeah.
And I became obsessed and sought out all the books at the local library and checked those out and read all those, you know, and fell in love with it. Throughout the years, there's always been a slight shrine in my bedroom growing up and decor and stuff. So
we really hit a nerve here.
Right? It's been in my heart. And we had talked about adapting a show, doing a show together. And, you know, all the Baum books are in public domain. So we kind of reread them all to see, like, is there one in particular that feels like it jumps out to us?
Mm-hmm.
And in all the stories, he has a letter to the readers talking about, you know, that particular book. And we kind of found this narrative throughout these letters to the reader.
Uh-huh.
And like, there's more to this guy. Like, I knew a little bit about him growing up, but it was mainly the content of the books. And then we did a lot of research and, yeah, found out this is a fascinating man that people don't know about. And they don't know about the scope of his.
I saw the documentary on Hulu or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And the only thing I remembered was the phrase fancy poultry, which turned up in your show.
Yes.
So that's interesting to me. Eric, who wrote the book, talk to me about the sort of research you had to do, the sort of deep dive into who Baum was.
Yeah, well, we read a lot of books about him, and we read a lot of the things that he wrote, including the 14 Oz books, but he wrote other things as well. And we were particularly intrigued by, as Michael mentioned, the sort of relationship that he had with his most famous creation, The Land of Oz. And there was a particular biography of him by Rebecca Loncrane called The Real Wizard of Oz that was very inspiring to us, she makes a lot of interesting observations about things in his life, at various points in his life that may have inspired certain elements of The Wizard of Oz, and then also looks a lot at sort of his relationship with his creation, not only from sort of the financial gain it brought him, but also just the varying the way his relationship changed with the books over time, sort
sure.
of having a falling out with feeling a bit trapped perhaps by this these golden handcuffs he'd created for himself.
Golden handcuffs. And then, I like that. Yeah, okay.
And then, yeah. but very much by the time he returns to writing Oz books, to write the last 8 Oz books, he wrote 14 in total.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely takes on the mantle of kind of the Royal Historian of Oz, which he gives himself as an official title. And you very much feel that he is at home in that mantle, and he has achieved this level of appreciation for his life and his achievement that we could all hope to have for ours.
Oh, in 100 years, people are going to be listening to these podcasts and going, you know, that guy was brilliant.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, and Frank Baum is a great example, though, of an artist that would never have seen how he is seen by us now
mm-hmm.
within his lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, he very much wanted to be respected as kind of like a serious literary figure and never really achieved that during his lifetime. But I think that in retrospect, his work, especially in the Wizard of Oz books, is much more appreciated as literature now than it was.
Well, you know, that certainly comes across in the show, you know, when the publisher's letters come over, you know, don't send us any more non-Oz books or whatever they
right.
say. It's sort of like you can sense his frustration with it. Why do you think, especially in that era, he sort of, I don't want to say turned from it, but, you know, really craved that literary, you know, admiration as somebody who didn't just write children's books? That's very much a fulcrum of your story.
Yeah. I mean, we can only sort of like speculate on that, but you know, I think that when things are incredibly successful commercially in their time, they tend by critical minds and critical eyes sometimes to be written off as sort of popular drivel. And I think that his work was very much seen by some of the kind of literati of his time in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times in our history, his work has been banned in various times for various reasons. We mention in our play that in 1928, all of the Oz books were banned from public libraries.
Because they were
said to be ungodly, in quotes, because they portrayed women in leadership roles.
In leadership roles. And that, of course, makes Roxanne's character, Matilda, kind of go, who is not with us anymore at that point, but she's still there. Interesting the way you did that, by the way. Go see the play. You'll know what I'm talking about. But yeah, women in leadership roles, I remember kind of going, really? So you must have found all kinds of things in your research. And everything is based in fact, I'm guessing.
Yes, absolutely. Even the sort of magical realism aspects you're referring to come from elements of truth that Matilda Jocelyn Gage and the Baums were theosophists, and so they very much believed in reincarnation.
And Ken, I think, mentioned seance or something.
Yes, and they held many a number of seances for various reasons, but a number of them were conducted in order to try to speak to Matilda. So her appearance.
We'll cut that out.
Yeah, her appearance in corporeal form in the play is very much tied to something that's real as well.
Wow. You know, it was interesting for me. I mean, it was as an audience member, it was not what I expected, because I sort of expected the whole sort of Wizard of Oz thing, and it was very much Frank's story.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about the collaborative process, how you guys kind of came together on where this was going to go.
Well, first of all, I like to kind of describe the show. My, like, one-sentence pitch is Sunday in the Park with George meets Finding Neverland, kind of a look at the relationship, you know, between an artist and his work. Yeah, I think we had a general outline as we worked, but a lot of it has been back and forth in tandem. Like, he might write some scenes, and then I'll write music to that, or vice versa. And it's definitely changed a lot over the years as well, especially since the pandemic. You know, this was supposed to come out in 2000.
Oh, yeah.
And
2020.
Yes, sorry.
Oh, 2000. Yeah, it's really old, folks. These guys were just kids when they started.
But I feel, I mean, we've worked together for over 10 years now on other projects, and I think that has led to this, like, the shorthand way we speak, and just the willingness to play and think outside the box definitely, I think, led us up to this point.
Well, so there was, as you say, the idea that let's collaborate on something original that's been sort of stewing for a while. Because of the way you work together.
Yeah.
But why this? I mean, I think you mentioned this at the beginning of the show, but whose idea was it? Let's start there.
I mean, I think it definitely comes from Michael's connection to the Oz books, that we wanted it to be something about The Wizard of Oz or Oz or L. Frank Baum's books, specifically the Oz books, though. But I think it was after reading the Rebecca Loncrane book that I really approached Michael with, like, what if we made it be more about this relationship that he had with these books and didn't so much focus on a specific, like, adapting a specific story?
Right. Well, that's the light bulb moment right there. Have you guys seen the film of Return to Oz?
We did last night.
We had a screening of it at Free Fall last night.
Oh, that's right. You did. I read that. I remember thinking, that is like the freakiest movie.
Yes.
And TikTok is in it, and there's all this. Yeah. But the whole thing with her heads, and stuff, I mean, how bizarre. I mean, you could have adapted that one.
Well, that's actually books 2 and 3 go together to make up that. And those were books that were, you know, those are some of the most read and sort of most appreciated from the 14, besides the very first one, which, of course, is sort of the magnum opus. But, yeah, I mean, those books actually figure pretty largely into the play that we ended up writing. But I'm really glad we ended up doing what we did. It also made it much more of an original piece than a straight adaptation, which was really exciting
to work on. Yeah, I think everybody loves biopics, right? And what's the story behind, or, quote, the man behind the curtain?
What's the story?
But it was a great way. Like, this is an American literary pioneer. And Dorothy is known as, like, one of the true feminist roles in children's literature. I mean, she was the way she approached life. There's so many beautiful things throughout the Oz series, and it was a way to really bring a lot of those in. And also, it was a really fun challenge and joy to find the moments where an artist is interacting with his creation. Like, those are some of my favorite moments in the show, where he's talking with the scarecrow, or he's having these deep conversations about life to little Dorothy, who has such a beautiful look on life. Frank really believed in kind of a utopia America, you know, where women were in charge and had equal rights, and where everybody was celebrated for their individuality. And those are beautiful things that are just as prescient as ever. Like, those are things that really touched me reading the books.
Absolutely.
Like, this has, if anything else, aged so beautifully.
One of the things that I thought was a nice touch was that Dorothy is there pretty much all the time. And, you know, and obviously, like, the other three characters other than Frank and Maude become other characters, you know. Mm-hmm. But Dorothy is pretty much in various incarnations a character in this show. And I thought that was a really nice touch. I wanted to ask you about, we talked about this for a brief second. Let's put you guys together in a room and go back to the collaborative process for a second. Yeah. You know, I got a nice idea. I'm playing an imaginary piano here, folks. You can't see it. I got a nice idea for a melody. What do you got? Or I'm thinking this could be Maude's song with her mother. How does that work between you guys?
That was fascinating with this project, because the arc of the story has changed over the years. The first song we wrote is Maude's song, He Tells Stories. And that was kind of, I feel like, the heart of the show for – that was kind of something guiding us. And there was other songs, like a song I wrote, not even knowing if it would appear on the show, is a kind of the Scarecrow origin song, mm-hmm. Not There. And that.
Oh, I like that. That was good.
And that was a way to really go back to the books and tell, from Frank's point of view, 100%, like, those are all very specific details that he wrote about Scarecrow. His eyes were a different size and aspects of that. And that I kind of wrote, like, this is something I'm just feeling in my heart. It might not end up in the show. And Eric found a beautiful way to put that into the show, with Frank experiencing writer's block and for him a chance to kind of commiserate with one of his greatest characters. So there was a lot. Sometimes the song led and then a scene was written around that, and sometimes just the opposite. It was really kind of back and forth with that.
So, I mean, it would take many different forms. I mean, if I would write a series of scenes, for instance, I might get to a point in the scene where I feel like, oh, well, this is going to go to a musical place right now. Like, the scene is built to the point that there's a song here, and might offer some suggestion of the shape that song might take and where I would go with the scene, right, were it a scene. Or maybe I would just write the whole scene. Like, for instance, the Mr. Smith stuff in the show, there's a very minor character from his third book that we kind of expand upon with our imaginations in the play. And that stuff I just wrote as scene. And for a long time, we talked about, oh, well, this part of this could be musicalized, or maybe this whole thing becomes musicalized because it's kind of lyrical in the language it uses already.
Yeah.
And it ended up in the show as scene, like, it's all scene. But other times there would be a suggestion perhaps from me for a song, and Michael might take that in some totally different direction. Or Michael, for instance, as he just alluded to, wrote certain things in other versions, you know, in other drafts of this as he was exploring, like, for instance, the He Tells Stories song that's Maude's, that came out of thin air as Michael's idea for this moment that Maude would express this idea. And it found a really beautiful place where it does in the show.
That happens during the process, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, so both directions.
You give me something, and that makes me think of something else.
Exactly.
And I can go. Talk to me, if you will, about the whole process of getting this on its feet with a cast. You know, are things changing constantly as you see it in front of you?
There were definitely adjustments to the show. There was one. There's these little Mr. Baum letters that appear throughout, and those are based on real
Mr.
letters
Baum,
that we
Mr.
found.
Baum. Yeah.
That it's and that's kind of this through line of these.
Those are real.
And I you know, altered stuff, but like the basis of that are
sure.
real.
Yeah.
And there was one. We wrote an additional one to like. In tech, we're like, we need one more little moment here to start act two. And so we gave it to amazing actress Elizabeth Meckler, and she learned it in a day, and it was perfect. We just knew we needed one more moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, the Not There, we wrote some reprises of that kind of came very late in the process, too. Mm-hmm. We felt like we needed a little more moment. And other things, too, just exploring even the content and the arc of songs.
I mean, by the same token, you know, not to dwell on this, but were the things that just didn't work when you saw it? Let's cut that, guys. You know, they do that on Broadway all the time. That's out.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yes. I mean, we'd worked on this for so long by then, though, that we very much had a script that we were ready to go into rehearsal with. So the changes of that nature, I would say, were more like little lines here and there. We didn't really get rid of any scenes or anything.
Okay, yeah.
But we moved things around in some significant ways. And I guess the biggest change that Michael also sort of like referred to a moment ago was needing this other moment to open act two, because we'd originally written it with the intention it would play at about 90 minutes with no intermission. Mm-hmm. And so when we realized that there was too much material for 90 minutes, which we never expected, well, I mean, we sort of thought it would be somewhere between 70 and 90 minutes. But as we were approaching tech, we were seeing, okay, well, this is longer than 90 minutes. And once we've gone over like maybe an hour and 40 minutes, that's too long to play in one act. So we really had to split it into two acts. Sure. So we needed to find a way to do that.
And I had no idea. Roxanne is someone I've known for quite a few years. I had no idea she could sing.
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah. And she's kind of one of my favorite. She has this moment in the show that's almost like a Bedknobs and Broomsticks meets Mary Poppins, you know, like Frank, get to it, right? You know, your next book. Which that is actually an interesting song. The song Believe It or Not, I think, was the second song I wrote, and that has changed. Its purpose and intent has changed so many times. Initially, it was going to be Frank talking to reporters, kind of like, and then it was something else. And then when we found in this version, oh, this is interesting. If it's his mother-in-law that comes back, and it just took on a whole other vibe and works in the best way, I think, of all the versions. So it's just funny how things find their home.
Well, you see, you're living inside the world at that point.
Yeah.
You can say, well, this moves this way, and everything that you have fits in a certain way. I did want to talk with you, Eric, about the business aspect, if you will, of launching something that didn't exist before.
Right.
That people, there's no precedent for saying, I heard about this show when they ran it off Broadway. And, you know, I mean, brand new stuff. Yeah. Is that a risk business-wise?
I mean, I guess to an extent, but I think that this does bring the cachet of The Wizard of Oz with it, and the title is just that, is Oz. Mm-hmm. So I think people get some sense of what they're coming to when they just hear that or decide that they might want to buy a ticket. Yes, but there's always a risk when it's a new piece, and especially one that, you know, we're developing that has never, you know, it's never been on stage anywhere before, and we're creating it from scratch. So there is a level of risk to that. But that's part of where the name of Freefall comes in, is that we believe in risk. So and we have to, you know, mitigate that risk. Right. You don't see us doing six world premieres in one season. Right. We pick them. We do maybe one or two new things in a season, and with a mixture of tried and true pieces, and then also maybe pieces that have been done elsewhere but are also lesser known. So we try to have a blend of things. But actually, I think organizationally we've seen this piece as more of like a sure thing than as a risk over time, just because of the recognition of Oz.
Yeah. Understood. You found, and I can't remember the actor's name, forgive me, his name is David Foley Jr., who plays Baum, and I mean, everyone is so good. Was it four or five of them? I can't remember. Five of them. Yeah. Thank you very much. But he was amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, where'd you find this guy? He's been on stage here before, I read.
David and I did Finding Nemo the musical at Disney World together.
Wow.
Yeah, he played Marlin.
Who were you?
I played Gil. He's voiced by Willem Dafoe in the movie. He's the in the tank gang.
In the tank gang. Oh yeah, okay.
The one who instigates the escape.
And David was Marlin.
And David played Marlin, absolutely.
Right.
And from there, when I founded Freefall, our very, very first production, which we did at the studio at 620, shout out to them, thanks so much, studio at 620. we did our very first production there, The Wild Party, which Roxanne was also in, another musical Roxanne was in.
There you go.
And David played the lead in that as well, Burrs, in The Wild Party. When we were setting out to do this, I started advocating for him to play the role to Michael from the very beginning, because he looks so much like him. His spirit is also so similar to the way I imagine Frank's sort of personality and spirit to be, having read so much about him. And he's just such a talented artist as well. I knew that he would take this on with the kind of like heart and care that it needs. And it's a beautiful performance.
Yeah.
What happens next for Freefall? Is this the end of this season? I honestly deal with a lot of theaters, and I can't remember. Yeah. Where are we in the scheme of things?
Right. Well, Oz is officially the last show of this current season, and yeah. we have our next season announced. It's available up on the website, and people should be seeing a brochure if they're on our mailing list in their mailboxes soon. Another 5 shows to add to the list for this coming season, and we're super excited about all that.
Begins when?
We start right off the bat again, like late August. Something opens mid to late August.
So, like typical, like professional theater people, you take a very short break.
And yeah. We're pretty much year round now, especially with our current subscription model, where people pay monthly. We like to keep programming going to keep those subscribers engaged.
Absolutely. I like this sort of weekend stuff between shows that you do. And I wish I'd seen. Well, actually, I own Return to Oz on DVD, but I wish I'd known about that because I would have been there. It's fun to see in a room with other people. Oz, a new musical, runs through July 9th at Freefall Theater in St. Petersburg. You can go to freefalltheater.com to find out more and get tickets. And that's theater, TRE.com. Not the other version, but TRE. Depends on who you ask, folks. Guys, anything else you want to say before we wrap?
No, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. And come and explore Oz with us.
Yeah, it's so good to see you guys. I appreciate you showing up.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
From stpetecatalyst.com.